Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us. Hello everyone, welcome to episode number 41 of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today on the podcast, I speak with Reverend Jonathan Barker about racial justice, climate justice, and his book, Jesus Would Demand a Green New Deal, the story of why one Christian pastor went on a 12-day fast for a Green New Deal. Some topics of discussion on today's episode include the call for Christians to be involved in social, racial, and climate justice efforts and advocacy, Reverend Jonathan's involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement, and the intentional, strategic, nonviolent direct action he has engaged in to protest the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year. We also talk about white evangelical Christians' silence around racial and climate issues. We discuss why Jesus would demand a Green New Deal. We also talk about the disproportionate impact of climate change on people who are already oppressed, vulnerable, and marginalized. And we talk about some of the ways that we can address climate change while also addressing poverty, underemployment, and unemployment. Reverend Jonathan Barker serves as the pastor at Grace Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and is the co-founder of Grace Welcome Center. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like our show, please subscribe, rate, review, or share it. This helps get our work out to others. Thank you very much. Reverend Jonathan Barker, thank you so much for joining me on the Unconventional Dyad Podcast today. I'm very excited to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. It is a true privilege to be on your show.
Yeah, let's get started. Would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners? Maybe tell us a little bit about your personal, professional identities.
So I am a ELCA pastor. I have the privilege of serving a very progressive denomination. So we are the Progressive Lutherans. We do things like we just celebrated our 50th anniversary of ordaining women. We also just celebrated our first elected trans bishop. And so we have a lot of work to do, certainly as a denomination, like everybody does around justice issues, but very proud of some of the big steps we've taken. And then in the last 5 years, I've served as the pastor at Grace Lutheran Church in Kenosha. And in that time, we've been able to do a lot of stuff in the local community. One of the biggest things we've done is we started what's called the Grace Welcome Center program. It includes a breakfast program that serves right now about 100 people free breakfast each week. And then on Tuesdays, we have the second biggest pantry in Kenosha that since the pandemic serves about 135 families per week, food pantry services. And we're so glad to be able to lift up our neighbors that way. And then our church has been in the middle of everything around Jacob Blake. We're about 2.5 blocks away from where the uprising happened. And we've been able to seek justice for the Blake family over the last many months now. And then when it comes to other non-professional identities, which is always fun, I always appreciate getting asked other identities. So I am married to a wonderful wife who also works hard for justice. She's a domestic violence advocate at Sojourner Family Peace Center up here in Milwaukee. And on the side is an artist. And we, for her work, actually live in Milwaukee. So we live on the north side of Milwaukee and are proud Northsiders. And then just little fun facts, we are whole food plant-based vegans, and we are minimalist, and that minimalism actually is what enables us to do the work we do. Neither of us are paid full-time, and because we're able to keep our expenses low, we can do stuff for our communities. And then I guess the last thing I'll just name is we are a huge solar panel and electric car enthusiasts, and so I've been driving my electric car since 2014. And we've had solar panels since 2019 and love evangelizing that and also just helping people learn more about that.
That is incredible. Wow, those are some things I actually didn't know about you, but it makes sense given kind of what you're interested in, what you're involved in. So I would love to talk more about just some of your environmental efforts. I don't think we've had a vegan on the show before. So I actually was vegan for several years and I'm vegetarian now. I hope to one day go back to being vegan, but it's really nice to get somebody who, and I'm assuming that that's part of kind of your environmental practice.
Yes, became a vegan 10 years ago around limiting my carbon footprint around food.
Yeah.
And what led you from vegan to vegetarian?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. It's more related to my health. And when I say this, I don't want people to think like, oh, we knew it, veganism is unhealthy. It was a personal thing for me that was very specific to my circumstances at the time. So it's not, you know, I'm not telling people that being vegan is unhealthy and that I'm having health issues because of veganism. But me being vegan right now is not feasible because of some of my health issues that I'm kind of going through. So I always kind of hesitate to tell people that because I feel like a lot of people are looking for excuses to not try veganism. But yeah.
Well, and just so your listeners know too, vegetarianism is also a huge reduction in your carbon footprint eating as well, and also goes a long way towards ethical eating in terms of animal rights. So
yes,
you know, vegetarianism is a wonderful solution as well. And even doing things like Meatless Monday and moving from ground beef and veal and some of the more intensive meats to less intensive meats even helps. So there's a lot of ways to make ethical food decisions.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. Yeah, any step that people can take to watch their carbon footprint and reduce it a little bit is great. But yeah, awesome. So you mentioned a few things. Just for our listeners, we have some listeners who are not from the Wisconsin area. So I'm based in Wisconsin. You're in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Just for our listeners who are not from Wisconsin or maybe aren't aware of kind of what went on in Kenosha last year. Last year, there was a shooting of Jacob Blake, like you mentioned, 29-year-old black man who was shot several times in the back by a police officer in Kenosha on August 23rd. So last year, yesterday, right? Last year?
Correct.
And he was paralyzed from the waist down. And so there's been, you know, there were obviously protests when it first happened. And it sounds like there's been continuous protests and people kind of advocating after that. And you've been very involved with that. Do you mind just speaking about your involvement with some of those protests?
Sure. So let me back way up. So I've been involved actually in Black Lives Matter going way before Jacob Blake. Here in Milwaukee back in 2014, a young man named Dontre Hamilton was shot in front of a Starbucks by police officers for taking a nap. And I got to participate in that with actually another Lutheran pastor, Pastor Steve Jerby, who basically let that movement be led out of his church and did things like, I was part of the group, if anybody remembers who lives in Milwaukee, we shut down the 43 with a human chain for 10 minutes. And we did other things. We took over City Hall. So that's many ways I learned from Coalition for Justice. I learned from the Hamilton family what this was like, and then brought all that down to Kenosha and have ever since the very first day I've been the pastor at Grace. The very first week I was there, Philando Castile and Alton Sterling got murdered by police officers, and we had a vigil the fifth day I was at Grace in our front lawn for them. We certainly got involved in the aftermath of the George Floyd shooting last summer before Jacob was shot. And then, as you mentioned, and is our church is right in the middle of all of that. We got very involved with the Blake family. And I have to name that they're just an amazing family that has been humbling to work with. They have worked so hard to keep things peaceful in our city. They worked really hard to de-escalate many situations. And they have worked to get justice that is well-deserved for Jacob Blake. And our church has had the great privilege of doing things like hosting mass meetings in our basement, which has been a tremendous thing that I'm just excited about, to see the faith community opening up our space for big community meetings about how to get justice. And we've been able to be very active. We were able to host Reverend Jesse Jackson, who wanted to come and participate in an event with the Blake family. We were able to do a community listening session with, at that time, Vice President Joe Biden at our church. And then we've been able to, as a church, participate in things like the Long March from Kenosha to Milwaukee. We were able to participate in the occupation of Civic Park all night. And we've been part of many prayer vigils and many planning. And also, I was personally part of the team that did a sit-in in front of the public safety building in Kenosha when the officer who shot Jacob 7 times in the back was put back onto desk duty. And so we were able to shut down the public safety building for about 7 hours. And myself and Justin Blake, Jacob's uncle, and Joe Cardinelli all ended up intentionally getting arrested and intentional strategic nonviolent direct action in front of them around this just incredible injustice that this officer would be put back on the force. And unfortunately, we haven't seen as much change as we would have hoped. There's been no change in terms of this officer's status. He didn't face any charges. He's still on the force. And there's been just very superficial reforms throughout our city around policing. And then also, like many cities in the upper Midwest, there's deep-seated racism at the core of our city, including intense segregation and many other challenges that our city faces. And unfortunately, we haven't seen much or almost any work on those fronts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You're doing incredible work, and it sounds like you've been involved with this from kind of the get-go. That's really incredible, because one of the reasons why I asked you on the podcast is because I don't see a whole lot of Christian leaders engaging in these kinds of efforts. And I think just in general, a lot of Christians and Christian leaders that I've come across just don't really talk about this stuff or don't get involved with it. So racial justice, and we'll talk about climate justice in a little bit, there's just very little conversation around that. And so I'm fascinated when I do see Christian leaders getting involved. And I want to know more about that. What drives you in that direction?
Well, I'm going to get to that part of it in a second, but want to just name a little bit around Christian leaders and involvement. Now, certainly white evangelical Christian leaders have been incredibly absent on so many different issues in our public sphere, including racial justice. And we could talk about a long history about that, if that's of interest. But certainly the Black church, for instance, has been very involved in matters of racial justice for its whole history, including going way back to efforts around abolition, and then, of course, was a catalyst for the civil rights movement. And we still see people like Reverend Barber leading the Poor People's Campaign. But I think your comment that the white evangelical church, which oftentimes is portrayed as the dominant church, has been embarrassingly silent on these issues. As a person of faith, this is incredibly important to me to be involved because of our scriptures. Our scriptures talk about justice often. God, through the prophets, oftentimes says things like, you can worship me and you can sacrifice things to me, and if you don't have justice, it doesn't mean anything to me. Many people maybe have heard the famous verse from Amos 5:24, let justice come down like a mighty river. The verses right before that basically say, and if that doesn't happen, your worship and your sacrifices mean nothing to me. And so there's this tremendous call in our faith, and it's not just in the prophets, but Jesus himself comes on giving his very first sermon, and he says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of Jubilee. And these are big justice issues, right? Letting the oppressed go free. Jubilee is a fancy word for debt relief. Jesus is calling for the end of all debt in his first sermon. And then Jesus goes about living this out in his ministry, healing people and bringing people from all sorts of marginalized backgrounds into the community. So Jesus himself works for justice. And not only is this a call, but leaders in the scriptures oftentimes are confronting powerful people. So the prophet Jeremiah, for instance, will take out all the leaders of Jerusalem, and he'll do some prophetic, symbolic resistance sort of things. He'll shatter a pot. He'll wear a yoke up for a yoke of oxen around his shoulders. He does weird symbolic protests that, you know, there was a young woman protesting campus rape who carried around a mattress for a year of school. These are really powerful symbols that get people's attention. And our faith tradition leaders were doing that. And when Jesus goes into the temple and starts throwing over tables and emptying coins and disrupting that, there's a confrontation with power. And we see that with Moses confronting Pharaoh and Nathan confronting King David. There's a long history, not only of the fact that we need justice, but we need to confront the powerful ones that keep us from getting it. And then it goes beyond just scriptures, but there's this long history of Christians for millennia have sought justice. I'm so inspired by the early abolitionists, especially. There was a Quaker abolitionist who in the 17th century, so this is about seven generations before abolition actually happened in this country, started naming after he saw the slave trade firsthand as a working on a ship. He said, there's no way this is in line with neighborly love. And he started one person protest out in front of churches that had pastors that held slaves, Benjamin Lay. There's a great book about him. And I just love that story because he was willing to do something that he didn't see the outcome being possible. It took, you know, many generations, and yet he was willing to do this hard work. And I think about other abolitionists, Frederick Douglass and other leaders that would work from a very strong Christian background to end slavery. I think of the social gospel movement at the beginning of the 20th century, at the end of the 19th century, that worked really hard for labor reforms and urban reforms. I think of the civil rights movement, obviously led by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other clergy. I think of the anti-war movement and the way that that was led. And I think of our unique context here in Milwaukee. Our civil rights movement here in Milwaukee was led by Father Grappi, a Catholic priest. Our anti-war movement here during the Vietnam War involved a group called the Milwaukee 14, led by five Catholic priests who burned draft cards. And so there's this long heritage of people of faith standing up for justice. And unfortunately, there's a part of the church that has been silent, especially in the last 4 or 5 decades.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for all that. Yeah, I guess I should clarify and put a disclaimer out there. I'm a white woman, and I grew up in very relatively conservative white circles. And so my experience is not one of, you know, social justice and advocacy for people. But it's a good point to make that there are branches of the Christian church that have been doing this for years, and maybe other branches right now that haven't quite caught up to that. I am kind of curious about your thoughts on why you think maybe the white evangelical church right now and other white Christians are staying a little more silent on this, or a lot more silent on this.
So that's a really important question. And this is a really important history that needs to be shared. And quite frankly, I think there needs to be some accountability around this. But the Sunday after Reverend Jim Reeve was killed and martyred in Selma, and so there was a Unitarian minister who was beaten to death during the Selma action. On that Sunday, a pastor named Jerry Falwell stood up at his pulpit and he gave a sermon called Ministers and Marchers. And in that sermon, he called on the church to have no ethical voice and to only care for people's souls. And he was a Southern preacher. He was trying to get the church away from the civil rights movement because the church was very much invested in the civil rights movement at that point. And he wanted to maintain segregation, maintain segregation at the school that his church had. And he called for the church to basically leave the public sphere. And then in a strange way, about 15 years later, he re-engaged the public sphere, and he was one of the founders of what became the pro-life movement. And so we see this rather strange way that evangelical Christianity especially lives out their public faith, because much of the conversation is they're not involved in politics. They don't care about politics. And that's sort of true. They don't care about racial issues, or for the vast majority, they don't care about poverty issues. They don't care about things like climate justice and different things we'll talk about. But they do, in this other way, really care about politics, right? Because they are very invested in what I would call politics of hatred, right? They're invested in things like limiting LGBTQ rights. They're invested in limiting women's right to choose. They're invested in other things that are very limiting like that. So there's a way that they are involved in that type of politics. And that's, again, kind of the dominant way we see our Christians playing out their public life, that it's okay to be in the public sphere if it's about those issues, and it's not okay about anything else. And that's, again, I think a history that really needs to be examined. I think most Americans and most American evangelicals would be, well, I hope most would, be a little bit cringe, feel a little cringe thinking about the fact that this comes out of a response to a Unitarian minister being martyred and saying that actually pastors don't have a right to be out there, shouldn't be out there. I think there needs to be some more education and more awareness overall. But unfortunately, I think that mindset is just deep in our churches. And so many pastors that I talk about, especially that are more of an evangelical white background, they say things like that. Like, well, we don't get involved in politics. But I say, you've literally got crosses in front of your church about abortion. That's a political issue. So we'll leave it at that, but that's a deep, something that needs to be addressed. I will name that the mainline Protestant church, which unfortunately, I feel very privileged to serve, but unfortunately has been culturally declining and numerically declining for the last 50 years. Our denominations, and that includes the ELCA, the Presbyterian, Progressive Presbyterians are called PCUSA, and then the Episcopalians, and then the United Church of Christ, certainly some Methodist. These groups have been doing tremendous things in the public sphere going back to the 60s and before, and continue to do stuff like that. Here in Wisconsin, we have Wisdom, which is a huge faith-based organizing body that does faith-based organizing. In our denomination, we have a Lutheran Office of Public Policy Wisconsin. We have a pastor who is, we all fund her, who advocates for important public policy that's in line with our faith at the state level. And then we actually even have an office of advocacy in the ELCA that helps with direct actions even. So there are other ways to do this. And again, I think that needs to be lifted up as well, that there are other Christian groups. Unfortunately, we don't usually get presented as quote unquote Christians in the United States. And so if you're interested in this type of Christianity and don't live in Kenosha or Wisconsin, and you want to be part of some progressive stuff, you know, check out your local Lutheran church, your local Presbyterian church, your local Episcopalian church. And there might be some people that you are surprised to meet.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, quite honestly, like I mentioned to you before we hit record, I grew up Christian and I was raised Christian, and I didn't know about this, this involvement in advocacy and social justice until very recently, because for some reason, either I wasn't aware and I didn't pay attention, or some of the voices that we hear are just louder than others. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's really nice and refreshing to know that there are people out there who are doing this work in Christian circles.
And I think helpful to name that it definitely not your fault. It's definitely the culture of those churches. And there really is a religious system in this country that suppresses a bold faith witness around activism and justice. And I think that's, again, really important to name that's an intentional part of the system.
I was reading recently about, I can't remember where I found it, and I'm probably going to butcher this a little bit, but I was reading about the Holy Spirit and how in some translations of the Bible, the Holy Spirit, that term has is considered a spirit of advocacy. It has some sort of advocacy connotation to that phrase or that word. And so when I saw that, I was like, this makes so much sense. Like this is the kind of Christianity that I can understand and get behind. So it's really wonderful. Like I see that spirit of advocacy in your work, especially.
Well, amen. In terms of the Holy Spirit too, the Holy Spirit or the Spirit of God in the Old Testament descends on prophets who then do things like call for there to stop being the shedding of innocent blood, which includes the blood of orphans, foreigners, and widows. And so, yes, the Holy Spirit definitely empowers us for the work of justice in bold confrontation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because I'm just so curious how you got into this progressive Christian sphere. Like, what is your history with Christianity? Did you grow up? I know in your book, which we'll talk about in a little bit, your book you wrote, it's called Jesus Would Demand a Green New Deal. And you do talk a little bit about your history and kind of your background. But I'm just so curious how you got involved in progressive Christianity.
So full confession, I grew up in evangelical Christianity myself. So I'm not throwing stones at something that I don't understand and wasn't part of. And so I grew up in a church that was very involved in anti-LGBTQ issues and also was not as pro-life as some, but was definitely involved in the pro-life movement as well. And also had almost no voice in terms of other social issues. There was some work around food and, you know, sharing food and shelter, but there wasn't anything around kind of more progressive leaning ideas around how this could look. I actually left that denomination in 2008. I was living in California at the time, and there was a huge litmus test around, I believe it was Prop 9 at this time, around, that was a bill to outlaw gay marriage in California. And I really felt, I thought even until the day of the election that I was going to vote the way that I was being told by my denomination and by pastors that I needed to. And I got into the ballot booth and I couldn't do it. My own life verse is Psalm 34:18. The Lord is near the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. And I felt in that ballot booth, voting the way that I'd been taught and was being encouraged to, did not make any sense in terms of my own life verse. And so that was the end of me being part of that tradition, and feel actually very liberated since, and so glad that I can love our LGBTQ siblings, and in our church is LGBTQ welcoming in Kenosha, and have just such wonderful siblings in Christ who have different, come from different backgrounds. And so anyways, that, it was a tremendously liberating thing. And then I found my way into progressive Christianity after that. And I was equally like you, I didn't know any of this stuff existed. And I thought, wow, this, you know, is, where do I belong? And then all of a sudden I realized there's a whole lot of people that belong, that I kind of belong to. And that's been a really beautiful thing to find in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America has been a tremendous home.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. I hope you'll excuse my language, but I truly feel like you're like the definition of a badass pastor. Like when I think of a Christian leader who goes out there and really advocates for people and loves people, like the work that you're doing is just really incredible and really refreshing to see. And speaking of that, you are also very outspoken on climate justice and climate action. And so you wrote this book, Jesus Would Demand a Green New Deal. And I'd love for you to kind of talk about that book and your involvement in the climate movement.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and what a title to be a badass pastor. I'll take that. And yeah, no worries about language. But thank you. Yes, as you mentioned, I wrote a book called Jesus Would Demand a Green New Deal. Let's talk about the title first. So how did I come up with this title? Well, when I was growing up, there was this thing called WWJD, and people had all sorts of merch around it, and you could get it on bracelets and t-shirts and whatever. And basically what it meant is, at least how I was taught it is, you know, you were thinking about maybe like going to a party and drinking some booze and smoking some weed, and then you were supposed to say WWJD, and then you were supposed to say, I'm not going to do that. Lo and behold, by the way, a little side note, WWJD actually is a very radical part of Christianity historically. It actually comes out of the progressive movement in the end of the 19th century, and it comes from a book called In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do? And it actually outlines this kind of industrial northeastern little city, and how they start asking this question And basically what happens is all these social reforms and people are quitting their corporate jobs and they're starting what's called settlement homes, which is the precursor to homeless shelters. And the Salvation Army comes out of this moment of Christianity, the settlement house movement. And this book asks that question, which I love, and it's kind of a forgotten part of the church. And then interestingly, that book would actually go on to start both Christian socialism in this country and the social gospel movement. And another just little fun history fact that I love is the socialist candidate for president for 6 presidential election cycles was a Presbyterian minister, which kind of shows how this stuff was, it certainly isn't connected like it used to be, but there was such a strong link between progressive politics and Christian faith. And, you know, obviously hope to reclaim that and think it's an important thing when we think about titles. So why would Jesus demand a Green New Deal? Well, Jesus would demand a Green New Deal. And I wrote this right after AOC, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, released her Green New Deal resolution. And what struck me is this is a resolution that would go a long ways to keeping our habitat, our climate livable. And so if your readers have been, viewers have been seeing the news, the IPCC just recently released a new report, but in 2018, they released a report leading up to this one where they basically said, we got to keep climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And the hurricanes, the wildfires, the droughts, the floods, the sea level rise, these things are all caused directly by climate change. And what's going on now, which is terrible, is just a small little foretaste of what's going to happen if we keep warming our planet. And if we stay on the course we're on, we're going to be about 3 degrees. And right now we've warmed about 1 degree. So we can kind of imagine what that would look like. And in our Christian teachings, we teach that we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus, in fact, tells us what is demanded. We are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind, and we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. And I was at that point watching the Paradise wildfires, and like I said, lived out in California, was watching Hurricane Harvey come in to Houston. And these are people who are neighbors to me, and was watching these terrible things happen. And it came to me that neighborly love is about making sure our neighbors have a livable future. I did a baptism about 3 weeks before the resolution came out. And in the report, it said that by 2100, we'll be seeing these terrible consequences. And this infant that I'd had in my arms, who I baptized, you know, would be 80 years old when these worst of these, the climate change was happening. And it just was heartbreaking. And so for that infant, who's my neighbor, I have to care. And it goes beyond just making sure our neighbors have a livable future. But when we talk about climate, there's people that talk about climate change, but we also talk about climate justice. And climate justice is this idea that first, pollution and climate change have already harmed communities of color and communities impacted by poverty more than everybody else. And we might think about an obvious way that this happened down in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. But if you didn't have a lot of disposable income, how do you, and you don't have a car, how could you leave the city? And the answer is you couldn't. And so a lot of the African-American community, a lot of the communities impacted by poverty were stuck. And then our government sadly didn't respond quickly at all and let them be stuck for a very long time as things spiraled out of control. And not only does climate change impact those who are most vulnerable, but the current pollution system does too, right? So I actually did my very first VBS in South Central Los Angeles and fell in love with this wonderful neighborhood, and the kids were just spectacular. And about 5 years later, I got an email from the pastor and it had pictures, and they were doing extreme extraction in this neighborhood. So basically what was happening is these big trucks with chemicals were coming in. People were jumping out with hazmat suits on, 50 feet from apartments that the kids from our VBS had come from. And they are pumping this stuff into the ground that clearly was so toxic that they had to have suits and ventilators on. And again, that isn't uncommon, unfortunately, that the way that fossil fuel gets extracted does tremendous damage and creates a tremendous amount of pollution and other impacts. So climate justice names all of that, that there's a history of this. And then it also names this tremendous opportunity as we transition. And so I always think about this around Kenosha. So my church is in an area that boomed during the 1940s because of World War II. there was a brass factory about 6 blocks from our church. And what ended up happening is people from the farms in Wisconsin came to work in this brass plant because we needed brass casings for our shells during the war. And so that changed the way Kenosha is, and it employed people that previously didn't have opportunities like that. And then not only that, but then eventually the highway system came in, and that also changed our community. Unfortunately for us, that meant a lot of people moved away and left our neighborhood. And so that was a difference, but there's tremendous opportunity as we make big decisions as a society for uplifting people. And there's good paying green jobs, our neighbors and my church, we serve a lot of folks that are underemployed and make very low wages. There's an opportunity to really lift some folks up. So loving our neighbors is also about family sustaining jobs. And then also just say, as somebody that grew up in Los Angeles in the 80s, when I didn't realize there are mountains around us because the smog was so thick, and ended up with asthma, is a 7-year-old in first grade, missing 30 days of school and falling way behind academically, that, you know, neighborly love is about cleaning up our air and cleaning up our water. And that is possible if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. So anyways, the book came out of this idea that, you know, neighborly love is about a livable future for our neighbors, a family sustaining job, and clean air and clean water for all of our neighbors to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's so fascinating. Just a quick clarification. You mentioned VBS a few times. Is that Vacation Bible School?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Vacation Bible School, which is a week-long program in summer for kids to experience some church teaching, but also a lot of fun stuff like singing and games and arts and crafts.
That's right. That's right. Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. And so, yeah, I actually am doing my dissertation on the psychological impacts of climate change, particularly on vulnerable and marginalized populations. And so I've done a lot of reading around just how detrimental climate change and environmental destruction is to our most vulnerable neighbors. And I was reading about how, you know, factory farms typically, all their toxins and waste are kind of like thrown into the water sources of people who maybe are living at the poverty level or below poverty level. So it's a really huge issue. And I just love the title of your book because it really grabs your attention. And you mentioned in your book that was a sign that you had up at a protest. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so in the book, chronicles my first 12-day fast. So I went on a 12-day fast right after the Green New Deal came out. And there was a picture. That became the slogan of the fast. And the last day of the fast, and I could barely stand up. I hadn't been fasting as much. And we were all holding banners that said Jesus would demand a Green New Deal. So yeah, that's where that all came. And love, I'll just give a shout out to Pastor Jim Lynch from Kenosha that was standing right there next to me, holding me up during that press conference as I was looking pretty wobbly.
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine. Tell us about the fast. Have you done one or multiple fasts?
Well, so I'm kind of involved in three different fasts. So I went on the 12-day fast, as I mentioned, and then this past spring went on a 22-day fast with 6 other people. And then every Wednesday and Friday continue to fast for climate justice. And we'll be on, this Friday will be the 140th Friday fast for climate justice I've done, and have a little team that does that with me as well. And we've been mainly supporting Greta Thunberg and the school strikers. That's where that all came from. And I thought, you know, I can't really go on strike from church. That doesn't accomplish anything. And we don't have labor power as pastors that way. And quite frankly, you know, we give people food and do other stuff that really wouldn't help our community for me not to be part of. So how could I support them from a distinctly Christian standpoint? But I can talk a little bit about each of those fasts. So the 22-day fast was really an amazing experience because I announced it about 6 weeks before I started. And I thought it was going to be a one-person fast. And lo and behold, 6 other people joined me. And I, you know, you don't really think, wow, are there people want to join in not eating for a little more than 3 weeks? That just, it was so humbling. And do want to give a shout out to my other Wisconsin 7 fasters real quick. Vaughn Mays, who's a Milwaukee activist, joined us. Tori Lowe, who's also another Milwaukee activist and also a radio personality here that's doing just awesome things in Milwaukee, joined us. Justin Blake, Jacob's uncle, joined us. And then Jill Ferguson, somebody who does a lot of peace work here in Milwaukee. She joined us and she's been really active in the Line 3 protest. And then Andy Berg and Joe Cardinelli, who are some local government officials in Kenosha, joined us. So it was an amazing team. And we got to go all over the state. We got to do 7 press conferences all throughout Wisconsin seeking climate justice in our state budget. And I was so moved by different responses in different places. But I think the thing that I'll always remember from the press conference we did was in Dodgeville. And there was a 5-year-old, and I don't even know how she could read my book at age 5, but she did. The kids are much smarter because actually there's a couple of young kids that have read my book and it just blows my mind away because I was reading like The Cat on the Map when I was even.
Right.
but anyways, this 5-year-old had read the book and she brought her mom to the rally. And she came up and she wanted me to sign her book. And this was all, she was leading it. Mom was just there to make sure her 5-year-old was okay. But, you know, mom was clearly, she was interested, but not, she was being led by her kid. And she thanked me for fasting and she wanted my signature on her book. And that just filled me and the rest of our team with so much hope that, boy, this next generation coming up and this little girl and so many others we met, there are a lot of really good people that want to see climate justice in our state and in our country. So, boy, that was very powerful. The reason for fasting was inspired by Gandhi. Gandhi went on many longer fasts. And other leaders did too. Cesar Chavez in our country's history, who worked with farmer rights in California and Latinx issues in California. He did some very long fasts. And it felt to me like another rally, another protest. Those are super important. Don't hear this as don't do that. Please keep going to climate rallies and climate marches. But it struck me that we need to go to the rest of the toolkit and do some things that are a little more to up the pressure a little bit more. And so I thought fasting would be very appropriate for especially a person of faith, since that's part of our tradition. And felt that was equal to the emergency we're in. And the urgency. So that's how we ended up doing it. And then, like I said, we've continued to fast. So Joe Cardinelli and Jill Ferguson, they continue to fast with me every Wednesday and Friday. And we have some other people that fast with us sometimes. And I should name that too, in the 22-day fast, we actually had all sorts of people fast and pray with us for a day, more than I could count. And we had several people join us for more than a week. And just come out and support us that way. And it was beautiful and just powerful. And right now we're especially praying as we fast for this big reconciliation bill that some people maybe have heard about going through the House and the Senate right now. There's really a tremendous opportunity. I call it a once in a species opportunity because I think if we don't get this, we're gonna be in a world of trouble. But if we can get this reconciliation bill passed, which is really a down payment on the Green New Deal, we have a real shot at keeping our warming to 1.5 degrees. So we've been praying and fasting for that now for about the last month on our Wednesdays and Fridays fast. If anybody wants to join us, fasting for a day is very safe. You just have to, the only thing you have to be mindful of is you don't want to get dehydrated. Then it becomes not very safe. But as long as you stay hydrated and more hydrated than you think, you know, just keep drinking water. You know, that would be safe. And anybody is, of course, welcome to join us in that.
Can people join online or do you all get together? Like, what does that kind of look like?
That's a great question. We do it individually because we all, it just so happened the Wisconsin 7 are like the most busy, active, caring people in the world. And so we've always all been busy. So we fast individually as we go about the other tasks that we're called to do. So for me, I'm at church and, you know, and if there's a church meal on a Friday or Wednesday, I, you know, don't eat and that's, it all works out just fine. And if you're interested, you can find us on Facebook or whatnot. If you find Jonathan Barker, you can let me know and we'd love to support you in that. And we have a cardiologist who supports us in all of our work, Dr. Kevin Fullen, has been with us since day one, and he makes sure to keep us all safe. And he, I'll just share one other little tidbit about fasting that I didn't appreciate until I got into this, but it's actually not fasting that's dangerous for a long fast, but it's breaking the fast. And actually, when the concentration camps were freed in World War II, unfortunately, some folks who got freed ended up eating too quickly, and that actually can create a toxic and fatal occurrence in the body. It's not super likely, but it can happen. So anyways, our doctor, he actually made us all the food we needed for the first week. We were refeeding and kept us all safe. So we always want to make sure we do this with wisdom. And so we have our dear brother, Dr. Fullan, helping us with that as well.
That's absolutely incredible. Yeah. So it sounds like spiritual solidarity, basically, kind of what you're doing.
Absolutely. And it comes out of the book of Joel. So there's a small book called the Book of Joel. He's a prophet, and he's living through an ecological crisis of his own right. There's a locust famine, which has destroyed the crops of the land. And what does he do to respond? He calls the people to fast and pray. And I've always loved that. And in the Lutheran church, at least, we always read that passage on Ash Wednesday. So every year we read about, what do you do during a national calamity? You fast and you pray. What do you do during an ecological calamity? You fast and pray. So we are very much fasting in the spirit of Joel. And, you know, some people, quote unquote, Daniel fast or whatever, but we're Joel fasting.
That's wonderful. That's great. In your book, you talk about how you have hope that Christians will be inspired by their faith to take bold action to protect the planet and our neighbors from the worst impacts of change. Unfortunately, a lot of Christians, and again, probably more so white evangelical Christians, have unfortunately denied or minimized climate change over the years. Obviously, you see your Christian faith and climate justice as intersecting. You see climate justice as a part of your Christian faith. I guess I'm curious why you think other Christians do not see it the same as you do. And maybe, like, how can we talk to some of our Christian family and friends about this issue?
Thank you. That's a hugely important question. Yeah, how can we talk to our Christian relatives about this? Well, the first thing I would say is it really does come into what type of Christian people are. So I will name that in my own denomination and in the mainline Protestant world, where we've been active in so many social issues for so long, the problem is climate change has been a secondary problem, or care for creation has been a secondary issue. So, and we see this to this day, when we have an immigration rally or when we have something around food stamps or feeding folks, when we have an anti-poverty thing, when we have an anti-racism event, there are quite a few mainline Protestant clergy that will come out. We can have, 14 or 15 clergy in Kenosha show up to an issue like that. Unfortunately, when it comes to climate change, it's been much less. It's oftentimes, one or two at best. I was at a 1,400 person rally and only saw one other clergy, which was just heartbreaking, not too long ago. So it's been a secondary issue for mainline Protestants who do social activism. And then in the evangelical church, as we mentioned, they've in many ways resisted neighborly love or especially activism around this. So I think about so many different issues, and I think this is important to name. Our scriptures talk about welcoming the stranger, which is really about welcoming the immigrant. Unfortunately, how many Christians are people that think we should have a closed border and not letting Afghanis resettle? Yet our scriptures talk literally many times about how we are going to be judged if we don't show neighborly love to folks like that. Another thing that always strikes me is in our faith tradition, we've been very invested in healthcare. Going back to Jesus, the very first hospitals were created by the church. We still see the history of this in our church and our hospitals to this day. So, St. Luke's in Milwaukee, St. Catherine's in Kenosha, these were started by Christians. And we've always been invested in everybody getting the medical care they need. And unfortunately, and that's following Jesus' footsteps of healing. And unfortunately, how many Christians want Medicare for all, another way to, love our neighbors? I think about poverty issues. In the book of Acts, the very first church, it says the early church, they shared everything in common, and there was not a single needy person in their midst. And again, you know, when it comes to anti-poverty programs, things like raising the minimum wage or whatnot, we see a failure to have just a kind of minimal decency of neighborly love. So, you know, that's a big problem there. And then it just carries its way into climate change. The other issue is, unfortunately, there's an idolatry in some of those churches. And there's this idolatry that, you know, it's okay if we end the world, because a lot of those churches are very apocalyptic. They are waiting for Jesus to come again. And they kind of think if we end up torching this planet, that's not a big deal, because we'll get, you know, we will be raptured up. And I certainly hope that Jesus comes back soon, but I know that that's not my decision. And in the book of Revelation, it's not, you know, it's not the church that ends up making Jesus come back. Jesus comes back when Jesus wants to come back. And so we can't destroy the world that God's given us. And if we think that's somehow doing God's work, we're in my mind being idolatrous. And so there's a real urgency around that. I think when it comes to speaking to our relatives, but then also I'll name that roughly 90% of our politicians at the federal level claim some sort of Christian faith. The same thing would be true in our state. Our public officials, we oftentimes have to approach them as people of faith. But I think the thing we need to stand on is this idea of neighborly love. Even though oftentimes neighborly love has been lost in our churches, and I think it really needs to be named that it's been lost, we can't afford to do that. And that denies the Bible, it denies our faith. And so we need to keep reminding people, if we claim that we are going to love our neighbors as ourselves, we have to make sure our neighbors have a livable future. We have to make sure our neighbors have family-sustaining jobs, clean air and clean water to drink. And not just our neighbors, but our neighbors' kids and grandkids. And can you really look at us and tell me that this five-year-old that's being displaced and is, so many people, you know, probably know, a lot of the reason people are even coming from Central America to our country is starvation and famine. And we have, and it's climate change related. And we have Lutherans, we have Lutheran synods down there. And we've actually had people from our synod up here in Milwaukee, down in those countries, while they're having blessing ceremonies for young kids coming up here because there's no food and there's so much violence in their community. And, you know, again, if we're going to claim neighborly love, we have to say those are our neighbors. Those are our siblings in Christ. And we can't just torch the world we live in.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think in my faith journey, I first struggled with neighborly love in terms of loving people who are very different from me. I also grew up, you know, in churches that were anti-LGBTQ. So for me, like the first step in my faith journey was, okay, how do I love my neighbors who are different from me? Now, I guess what I'm struggling with is how do I love my neighbors who maybe are similar to me in some ways, but I disagree with in terms of like political beliefs or issues like climate change and racial justice. Not to put you on the spot again, but do you have any sort of like advice or thoughts about how we love people that we disagree with ideologically?
Yeah. So our method is always loving, right? So in terms of, you know, we're not advocating, for instance, violence to stop the climate catastrophe we're in. And that would, if I wasn't a person that believed in peace and neighborly love, I think that certainly would be on the table as a appropriate response. So, I mean, just starting with the fact that we have, by tactic, you know, by doing nonviolent direct action, we are, you know, intrinsically, strategically doing something that's meant to be loving, non-harmful. So that's important to be mindful of. And I think there's going to be more and more conversation about more extreme methods. And I hope the church can be a strong voice for, we need to be activists around this, but we need to do it in a nonviolent way. So that's the first thing I'd name. The second thing is, we absolutely need to all, just because somebody disagrees with us does not mean that they aren't worthy of love. And so many people that have hateful theologies or ideas are people that are hurting people. You know, they have their own wounds and their own scars. So, you know, we're certainly called to approach this with love and kindness. We're certainly, I pray for people that have very different views from me. I think that's, you know, something we should be about and believe that people's hearts can be changed. believe that people's hearts can be changed when we go forth with courageous, nonviolent, direct action. And then I think even how we speak. And I'm probably, like so many people, kind of horrified about the tone and temperature of how we speak to each other in this country. And I think, you know, how do we speak in a loving way? I think one thing is we need to make sure we are always speaking truthfully. And I'm stunned on both sides of everything, how much non-truth gets said. So being a person of integrity, that's part of how we love others, is we trust that the truth will be enough. I think what we say, I don't think people that are worried about losing their jobs because of this transition, I think they need to be loved. I think part of what I want to see is as we transition away from fossil fuels, there's a lot of people that we need to care about. We need to make sure they're being loved as we transition, and that they're not abandoned. And I think that's a very real issue and concern. So I think we need to be making sure that's a huge part of what we're doing. I think we don't want to villainize people. And again, a lot of people making hard decisions. I don't fault anybody that works in a fossil fuel intensive industry that's doing it to care for their family. I don't blame them. And it's not their choice oftentimes, and it's not their fault. And so how do we have conversations that, you know, center love and center the goodness of each other? And in Christianity, we talk about having a charitable understanding. So part of not bearing false witness is, at least in the Lutheran tradition, is not bringing assumptions to the conversation, because in many ways, then I'm bringing a false witness against somebody. So how can we assume the best intentions, not the worst? And again, that's a pretty big call in terms of where our public discourse is, but I think that would be very helpful and also very much in line with our faith.
Definitely. That's beautifully stated. Thank you. Your book, you do talk about hope, and you talk about how your faith has kind of, you know, inspired you to be hopeful. It calls you to be hopeful. So with that in mind, what are your hopes for the future?
So I have two big hopes. The first hope is I pray and I yearn for this and I long for this, and pray especially on Wednesdays and Fridays with fervency on this. But I long for this church and the big church, not just Lutherans, not just, but the collective church, all of God's people, that we will have a big moment around standing up for climate justice and doing that, of course, with things like fasting and praying, nonviolent direct action of all sorts. And so I have a tremendous hope that that happens. And I again, see the historical precedents for that. The civil rights movement, the abolition movement, the worker rights movements in the beginning of the century. And I yearn and hope to see people of faith coming together around this issue and truly helping to transform this and be part of this movement to really save our habitable planet. And so that's my first big hope. And I have a tremendous hope and I have a feeling that if the church gets more involved, and there's certainly a lot of Christians that are involved, but if we can get more involved, and the vast majority of us can get involved, we have an important role to play, in part because of hope. That's something that we can bring to the space, in part because so many people that are right now standing in the way are Christian. And so, I think that's a big hope, that the church will rise to this moment. And I heard Bill McKibben one time saying he's a historic climate activist, and he's also a Methodist. He said the church was born for this moment and the world needs the church right now. That's a loose paraphrase, but and I couldn't agree more. This is our moment. This is our generation of Christians' moment to stand up boldly. And then the other hope I have is what climate justice could look like. And I think we have a future that is, to me, just so beautiful, and it's something we could have. And so there's all these interesting pairings. So for instance, I think about an issue in our neighborhood. In our neighborhood, the median income is $13,000 for a household. And that's really challenging to make it on $13,000 a year. And one big problem people have is they fall behind on their We Energies bills. And unfortunately, their apartments are not, we have the oldest apartment buildings in the city, and that means they're the most drafty apartment buildings in the city. And so they're tremendously expensive to heat. Well, and they're also, that means we're just burning carbon to heat leaky buildings. If we were to invest in these apartment buildings, we could save on people's bills while also reducing greenhouse gas emissions. That's like a beautiful win. And also we can put people to work doing that. There's about 60,000 people in Wisconsin right now working on building retrofits for climate efficiency. We're talking about good paying jobs. We're talking about lowering people's bills. That's awesome. That's like just a, I want that future. That's something I hope for. I think about electric cars. Our electric car that we've had now since 2015 or 14. Anyways, we've had to take that in for maintenance one time. There's one part for every 1,000 parts in an electric car. And many of the things that break down in a conventional car don't exist. All the heat and friction and pumps, none of that stuff exists. It's basically just a giant battery. And so there's tremendous opportunity to have low maintenance for cars, which also helps everybody. And not only low maintenance, but they're cheap. It's much cheaper to run a car on electricity than it is on gasoline. So I'm hopeful about that pairing. I'm hopeful about all the kids that can breathe clean air if we do this. By going to electric cars and solar panels and wind turbines and batteries, we can have a community that has clean air and doesn't have kids getting respiratory illness exacerbated by the air quality we have. And that's just a tremendously beautiful hope. And again, we can put people to work making electric cars, installing solar panels, putting up wind turbines and all the auxiliary stuff around that, and have our kids have just a clean, beautiful world to live in. And I remember the pictures right after the pandemic started and the world, you know, slowed down. And I remember seeing the canals of Venice, and all of a sudden there was sea life in them again. The air quality over many cities went from smoggy to clear. And so there's some just really beautiful opportunities in all of this. So I'm excited about the future. There's a challenge that we have to rise to meet this moment, and there's obstacles, but it is a really beautiful, neat future that I want to see. And my wife and I are at that point where we're hoping to have kids someday soon. And this is the future I want for my kids, for my grandkids, for my great grandkids, for children that I baptize, that are siblings in Christ. I want this beautiful world that's full of clean air, clean water, good paying jobs, and quite frankly, a lot of savings for everybody. I think there's a really amazing opportunity. So that gives me hope. And then the other thing I'll name that just gives me hope is so many great people that are standing up for this. And I think of the Swedish teenager, Greta Thunberg. I always think of her as a mustard seed. Our scriptures talk about how the kingdom of God is like the smallest of seeds, and then it grows into the biggest of shrubs. And this one teenager who 3 years ago last Friday, 16-year-old with a sign that said school strike for climate, within 3 months, 800,000 people were joining her. It's just amazing to me. And that gives me hope. It gives me hope. At the end of my 12-day fast, there were about 75 people in this church basement who cared about this issue, who wanted to see action. It gives me hope that, you know, 6 other people were willing to go on a 22-day fast with me. And, you know, we had people from all over the state participating. And you know, I think of that little 5-year-old coming up and getting her book signed. And boy, if we can avoid the worst catastrophes of it, I know the future's bright. It's just we gotta move quick on this one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I do want to put in a plug for your book. It's a very quick read, a really nice, short and sweet read. I got your book on Amazon. And so listeners, if you are interested, just a couple pages, right? Like not even 70 pages long, right?
Right. Hopefully it was written for the masses. I didn't want a long book that felt burdensome that people could read. And so, yeah, it takes about an hour to read maybe.
Yep. Yeah, it's very accessible. And I love that you weave in your own personal stories, things you've seen, things you've experienced, your activism. Like it's a really nice read. So I do want to put in a plug for that. I'll have a link to your book in the show notes. There's also a link to your book on our website. So listeners, if you want to check it out, please go ahead and do that. Again, that book is called Jesus Would Demand a Green New Deal. Yeah, anything else that you want to mention about the book or just anything that we've talked about so far?
When it comes to the book, just would appreciate all of you checking it out, telling your friends about it. Tried to create, a high-paced resource for people to get excited about. Great for church book studies. And so, it's not it's a book that would be accessible to read together. So yeah, would be honored for this audience to participate in that. Share it with Christian relatives. I've had some people send it to all of their Christian relatives, which is exciting. So another opportunity. And yeah, I guess I'll just name that. I hope for everybody that we'll start seeing this. I think there is one task for activists. I think oftentimes activists, and I consider myself an activist, we've forgotten to invite Christians and pastors to climate activism. And so if you are not part of a faith tradition, but you'd like to see this work continue and you see a value of it continuing, I think one task is, we invite the clergy to come to the immigration stuff and the anti-racism stuff, and that's beautiful, and let's keep doing that. But let's make sure we make that invitation to the faith community, and let's make sure that we always have some clergy with tab collars and their suits and all that participating. I think there's a lot of tremendous power in that. So really want to just plug that, and really do want to thank this community and thank all of the people in southeastern Wisconsin and throughout the state who have been so supportive of this movement. And just want to, just from the bottom of my heart, when you haven't eaten for 22 days and you're trying to get enough energy just to get out of bed, it's all the support around. And there's just so many people. I can't even name all of you, but just know that you're loved. You keep this work going, and we are really in this together.
That's gorgeous. Thank you. Yeah, one final question for you before we kind of wrap this up. Our podcast, Carly and I, Carly's not here with us today, but Carly and I started the podcast as a way to kind of continue educating ourselves. And so, with this podcast being all about education, I'm curious if there's like one lesson that you can point to from this past year, maybe from this past year and a half since the pandemic started, one lesson that you've learned and how you've implemented that lesson in your life.
I've got two lessons, if that's okay.
That's perfect.
The first lesson is about the power of nonviolent direct action. And so as we got ready to get arrested, we actually had a nonviolent direct action trainer come and do a day training with us. And there was some wondering what that was going to be like. Is it really worthwhile to spend a whole Saturday before we spend a whole Sunday sitting down doing this? And that ended up being just one of the most powerful experiences of my life. And is reflecting on it, it's something that, especially in the civil rights movement, they definitely did trainings before these arrests. And really want to just lift that up. It gave us so much more power because we kind of worked through some of our own demons together, which was really powerful and vulnerable. And it helped us have a tremendous moral witness. And it was such a powerful moral witness that it actually led to some violence being done against us, really against Justin Blake. The sheriffs actually basically put him in a torture chair after he was arrested for 9 hours. So he was strapped down with big leather straps in a pain position, and he was I got to see him at one point. We were all in separate rooms, and he was flush. But we all thought that the reaction and the negative reaction was part again of our power we had because we were so intentional and strategic. And so I just want to lift that up. And it changed the dialogue. It's one of the few times where I've within hours of doing an event, I had people saying my mind has been changed. And so just really want to lift up as we do this, how can we be strategic and intentional? So that's a lesson I've learned. I want to keep doing that, keep doing things like nonviolent direct action trainings and just being mindful of how I'm showing up in spaces. And then the second lesson I learned is I am somebody that you can probably imagine as somebody that goes on 22-day fast, that maybe self-care is not my best gift. And I had a wake-up call during the 22-day fast about how much I'm a people pleaser. So it was about day 20, day 20, day 21, and you know, I was safe. We had our cardiologist, but I was starting to really suffer and have very low energy. And I kept saying yes to things that didn't put me in, I didn't end up in the hospital or anything, but were a little bit reckless in terms of my health and the care that I needed. And also ended up leading to the Wisconsin 7 missing out on a few opportunities that would have been really exciting. Because I said yes to some things that were more to please people than to care for myself or to care for the movement. And so I've been thinking a lot about self-love since the fast, been trying to prioritize that, and how self-love can really impact who I am as a leader, but also impact the movement. And so I've really been trying to be intentional with my yeses and nos, and really trying to give myself the respect and love that I fight so hard for everybody else. And I think for activists, for a lot of activists, we struggle with this, right? And I think especially when we're in the work a long time, is we start to get run down and worn down and don't prioritize this. We accidentally do a lot of harm to other people, or at least miss out on opportunities that could be had. So just want to lift up the importance of self-love and self-care for ourselves and for our movement.
Definitely. Thank you for mentioning that. I think that's something that I myself struggle with, and probably a lot of other people struggle with, especially, like you said, activists who are involved in this. So thank you for bringing attention to that. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about your work?
So I'd be really excited for anybody to follow me on Facebook at Jonathan Barker. That is a great way to connect, and very active on social media. Another great way to connect with Wisconsin folks is we have church service every Sunday morning at 9:30 at Grace Lutheran in Kenosha. And you are all welcome. And I have a feeling that there's some wonderful folks that I'd love to meet from this podcast audience that could be part of our little mustard seed community that's trying to do bold things for Kenosha and for the world. So we'd love to meet you that way. And then the other thing I will name is if anybody wants to email me, my email is first name Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, period, W, period, Barker, B-A-R-K-E-R, 17 at gmail.com. And would love to hear from you directly that way. And would love to hear, especially if you're going to go on fast, please let me know. Would love to connect with you. Would love to be in solidarity with you in that if you are feeling so inspired. And also for anybody that's connected with churches, love doing teaching, small groups, book studies. And if you're in the southeastern Wisconsin or now with the Zoom world, anywhere in the world or country, would love to participate in that too, and have done that with several faith communities.
Great. Thank you so much. We will actually put links in the show notes to some of your socials, and I will also put your email that you just mentioned in the show notes so people can easily see that as well. Well, Reverend Jonathan, anything else that you want to leave us with or anything else you want to share?
Laura, I'll end with this. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This has been a lot of fun this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for agreeing to this. It was wonderful speaking with you. I honestly wish we had more time, because I think there could be so many different directions we could go with our conversation. And I really appreciate your time and the work that you do.